from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Over the years, some athletes have used their fame and high profile earned on the playing field or in the arena to draw attention to social causes or issues within their sport. One of the more prominent recent examples is NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick kneeling on the sideline during the national anthem to protest police brutality. Tennis pro Naomi Osaka and gymnast Simone Biles have led the way in sharpening the focus on athlete mental health. One of the more famous examples is Muhammad Ali refusing to be inducted into the Army during the Vietnam War. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about athletes and activism, past, present, and future. What impact has their activism had on society and in sports? Has it affected change? We'll discuss it, and we want to hear from you today on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Good to have you with us today as we talk about athletes and activism. Some sports figures take the sometimes risky step of using their voices and their fame, their spotlight, to bring awareness to social and political concerns. Racism, police brutality, gender equity, pay equity, just to name a few. Sometimes those issues occur within their own sport and become part of the national dialogue. You've probably seen the famous photos or moving images that illuminate some of this activism. Colin Kaepernick taking a knee during the national anthem at NFL games. Years earlier, Muhammad Ali going to court in his opposition to the military draft. Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising the Black Power salute at the Olympics in 1968. More recently, we've seen athletes like tennis star Naomi Osaka and gymnast Simone Biles take a stand to protect their mental health. There are many other examples as well. But we'll talk about all this today. What impact do these actions have on society, and what price do athletes often pay for stepping up? We have four distinguished guests with us today to talk about athletes and activism. And I believe we have two on the line, and we have a technical issue. We're trying to get the other two linked up, and we'll get to them as soon as possible. Let me introduce Johnny Smith, who is the Julius C. Bud Shaw Professor of Sports History and Associate Professor of History at Georgia Tech University. His research focuses on the history of sports and American culture. He has authored four books: War Fever, Boston Baseball and America in the Shadow of the Great War, with Randy Roberts; A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle, also written with Randy Roberts; Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, also co-authored with Randy Roberts; and The Sons of Westwood, John Wooden, UCLA, and the Dynasty That Changed College Basketball. Dr. Smith's currently working on a book about the emergence of Michael Jordan as America's favorite athlete and how the country's racial history shaped his ascendance in popular culture. Dr. Johnny Smith, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for that warm greeting. Good to be with you.
Also on the phone with us is Ms. Ann Lieberman, the Director of Policy and Programs for Athlete Ally, a nonprofit organization that they describe as working to dismantle the structures of oppression that isolate, exclude, and endanger LGBTQI plus people in sport, and has over a decade of experience in advancing LGBTQI plus rights and gender equity globally. Mix Lieberman, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Thrilled to be here.
Well, let me start with you, Anne. Mix Lieberman, just for the sake of getting to know you, tell us about your nonprofit.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, we work to dismantle the structures of oppression that isolate, exclude, and endanger LGBTQI plus people in sport. And we do that in four primary ways: through education, research, sport policy advocacy, and of course, athlete activism. We feel very strongly as an organization that athletes should never be told just to, quote, shut up and dribble, as we've heard, that athletes have, as you mentioned at the top of the show, a significant role in calling for social change in this country and beyond.
Well, one of the big issues that has come up recently is the issue of transgender athletes being able to take part in sports consistent with their gender identity. And the politicians, of course, have gotten involved in this. There's 16 states now that I think last count banning transgender students from taking part in sports consistent with their identity. Talk about the activism related to that. Who in the sports community is taking the lead in advocating for the rights of trans athletes?
We've seen so many incredible athletes across sports, across gender divisions in sport, speak up and speak out for trans athletes. So we've had Billie Jean King, Candace Parker, Megan Rapinoe, Megan Duggan. We've had incredible athletes in, you know, additional athletes in the NWSL, the MLS, the NFL. And, you know, what's been interesting about this conversation is we haven't always seen consistent media coverage of those voices of support of trans athletes. And the difference between the conversation that's often happening at the state level, which is banning trans kids from playing sports with their friends, versus the conversation around elite athletes. And we've had a really tremendous shift in the way many athletes are publicly speaking out on this issue, and it's been really, really wonderful to see.
Victoria Jackson is with us. Victoria is a sports historian at Arizona State University. Dr. Jackson, I should say, writes and speaks about the intersection of sports and society, exploring how the games we play and watch tell us about the communities, local, national, and global, in which we live. Her writing has appeared in numerous publications. Perhaps you saw Dr. Jackson on 60 Minutes discussing American college sports. Dr. Jackson is also a frequent podcast, radio, and TV documentary film commentator. She is also a former NCAA champion and retired professional runner, and she would like for her ASU school record in the 5,000 meters to be broken as soon as possible. Dr. Jackson, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let's move over to Dr. Johnny Smith. There are different types of activism, of course. Some athletes have brought faith into their careers on the field and in the arena. Muhammad Ali, we talk about him a lot here in Louisville, and Islam, one of the most prominent examples of that. Then Cassius Clay, embrace of and conversion to Islam, altered his life as a boxer, but it also influenced the world's view of Islam. And as you recount in your book, Blood Brothers, The Nation of Islam and Malcolm X, they saw Ali as a means of spreading the nation's message, didn't they?
Absolutely. Malcolm X recognized in his early interactions with Cassius Clay the potential for the Louisville Lip to disseminate the message of Elijah Muhammad, who was the Supreme Minister of the Nation of Islam. And I think what's remarkable about that relationship is that in the early 1960s, when young Cassius Clay was moving through the heavyweight ranks, he was spending time with Malcolm X and the other ministers of the Nation of Islam, he came to discover a political voice. You know, early in his career, boxing writers, they dismissed him as this brash, charismatic young guy who liked to brag about his boxing talents. But they didn't take him seriously beyond that. But what's interesting is in those years when Cassius Clay was spending time with Malcolm X and the members of the Nation of Islam, he was developing this black nationalist political mindset. He was learning about black history, American history, African history. And he was questioning white supremacy in ways that black athletes had not done before. And so there was this evolution taking place. The seeds were planted in those Nation of Islam mosques, but those seeds were also planted in the places where Cassius Clay came of age, including segregated Louisville, Kentucky. And so he's questioning everything, and he's also questioning, what is my role in society? Once he wins a heavyweight championship in 1964, he makes this claim, I don't have to be who you want me to be. And what he was saying in that moment was that I can be black. I can be proud to be black. I can be a Muslim. I can be proud to be a Muslim. And I can speak the truth. I can speak out against injustice. And it really was a turning point in the history of activism for athletes, particularly for black athletes.
And it really became, and we'll talk more about his resistance to the draft, but it became a moment where he went from just being a boxer to being really a sports icon and an activist in this country, right?
He became one of the most polarizing figures in America when he came out and announced that he was indeed a follower of Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam, he wasn't just criticized by white Americans. There are many black Americans who criticized him as well, because keep in mind, the Nation of Islam preached the separation of the races, that they did not want to participate in the integrationist goals of the mainstream civil rights movement. So you had people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Jackie Robinson who said that Cassius Clay, as a heavyweight champion, as a disciple of Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X, that he was a dangerous role model for young black Americans. And so this is a moment where he really has to assert his independence, that he decides that he's not going to give in to these pressures. He's going to follow his heart and follow the message and teachings of Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X.
We are going to take a break here. We are talking about athletes and activism. You just heard Dr. Johnny Smith, who is a professor of sports history at Georgia Tech University. Also with us on the line are Lewis Moore, historian and author, and he is at Grand Valley State, Victoria Jackson, sports historian and former collegiate and professional track and field athlete. And Ann Lieberman is also with us, director of policy and programs at Athlete Ally.
This is the motivation, the symbolism of what you did. Now, do you think you represented all black athletes in doing this?
I can say I represented black America. I'm very proud to be a black man, as I said earlier, and also to have won a gold medal. And this, I thought, that I could represent my people by letting them know that I'm proud to be a black man.
That is Tommy Smith, one of two black athletes to give the Black Power salute on the medal stand at the 1968 Olympics. John Carlos was the other. Tommy Smith interviewed about it there by the late Howard Cosell. We are talking about athletes and activism here on In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We have four guests with us to talk about athletes and activism. Ann Lieberman is with us, Director of Policy and Programs at Athlete Ally, and Victoria Jackson's also with us, sports historian and former collegiate and professional track and field athlete at Arizona State University. Lewis Moore is with us, historian and author, and also Dr. Johnny Smith, who is a professor of sports history at Georgia Tech University. Let me turn back to you, Dr. Moore. I've been looking through the history of activism in the sports world, and it is a long history. You know, we've been talking about more recent events here lately in the media. But this long history has a lot of times involved the American story of racism, the quest for equality, to paraphrase your book title, not only in our society and at large, but within the sports world itself. And this battle is still being waged, not only in our society in America, but in the sports world as well, right?
Oh, yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's a long history. And I like to date it like post-World War II when there's a lot of conversation about democracy and black athletes, and then the black athletes are finally saying, wait a minute, we don't get the same type of treatment in society, and started to, you know, talk about the need for civil rights and put themselves on in the front line. And you see the same thing today, right, in this kind of post-Trayvon Martin world. These black athletes are realizing that they're coming from the same communities as these people in the streets protesting, and they are realizing that they have to be part of this movement for change.
One of your books deals with, we've been talking about Muhammad Ali already here, and of course, we're based here in Louisville, but one of your books deals with boxing around the turn of the 20th century. I Fight for a Living, Boxing in the Battle for Black Manhood, 1880 to 1915. So this is, talk about that. This is a battle that goes back, you know, beginning of around the 20th century, right?
Right, right. Especially for these boxers, it's for them, it was just a way to make a living and try to make an American society. And one thing I point out to people, my students and other folks, is that during this time, I'm writing this book, one every 4 days a black person's lynched in America. And here are these black men who are, you know, essentially going into the ring and a lot of times fighting white guys to prove not only their manhood, but also make a living and then escape, right? One thing we have to keep in mind, July 4th, 1910 is one of the largest days of rioting in America. It happens after Jack Johnson beats Jim Jeffries. More than 20 black people are killed across the country. So this is the atmosphere that they're operating in. But unlike in the 1960s, a lot of times they're doing it as individuals, right? They're getting their money and supporting their family but not there's not a lot of movements that they're attaching to.
Let me turn to you, Dr. Victoria Jackson. First of all, tell us a little about yourself. Talk about your experience as an athlete and how that led you, as a college athlete, I should say, and how that led you to become a sports historian who studies the intersection of sports and society.
Sure, thanks. You know, I like to kid that I'm a product of collegiate amateurism, that when I was serious and scholarly, I studied history, and then when I was serious about being the best athlete I could be, I was focused on that, and it never occurred to me that I could connect the two. And so I was actually studying the history of unequal education in this country, and sport is a technicolor illustration of that. And so the potential here, I think, is that in the United States, we have school sports infrastructure that's really unique in the world, and sport can become a place for social change because of that. And it's educational too. So we can tap into the kind of the power of these intersections to really inspire our young people. You know, now I'm a professor and work with a lot of athletes to think about what they're learning through using their bodies in sport, the power that they get from that, the voice that they develop from that, and then apply it to the issues they care about in the world.
Talk about being an activist as a college athlete versus being a pro athlete, because on the college level, it would seem to be it would be more challenges. They're more difficult because you're in an institution and you're also part of another institution called the NCAA.
Well, the power dynamics of college sports make it really hard for current college athletes to focus their efforts on the power dynamics and structural problems of college sports themselves. There have been really fearless, bold, brave athletes who have done that, and it's often backfired.
Talk about your experience. Did you feel pressured somewhat to take a stand on certain issues? You know, there's as an athlete, because there's that old saying. I think John F. Kennedy said it, paraphrasing a Bible verse: "For those who much is given, much is required." What was that experience like for you?
Well, I would say that I was not an activist athlete while I was a current college athlete. You know, I use the classroom now to teach about this history so that I can create better informed citizens in the world who are both students and athletes. But I think, you know, the history that we can point to, like my sport, track and field, for example, is a really good place to look at both the history Dr. Moore was talking about and connecting it to the present, much like Dr. Moore was talking about. Track and field has long been the space of Black athlete activism, and it's Black women who've been kind of hidden from this historical record, who've kind of been the through line and the grassroots force all along. So Dr. Moore actually is the fabulous scholar who found in his research that the first Black athlete to protest during the playing of the national anthem was Rose Robinson, a high jumper, all the way back in 1959, using the moment of that anthem to call the country out to live up to its founding principles and ideals, you know, and pointing out that second-class citizenship that Black Americans were experiencing and fighting against to gain full access and full citizenship rights. And, you know, in 2019, a full 6 years later, hammer thrower Gwen Berry, in the same competition, the Pan American Games, raises a fist on the podium. And so I think, you know, this sport and these athletes have an ability that they recognize, because that opportunity to play itself is a political act, and especially for Black women in this country.
Well, Dr. Moore, tell us about Rose Robinson. A lot of these athletes are not as well known as others, right? But they still get out there and take a stand.
So Rose Robinson, what a tremendous person. A member, of course, of the Congress of Racial Equality, while at the same time she's an athlete in Chicago, and she, even before the National Anthem protest, she was helping integrate in a skating rink, actually had her arm broken in doing so. She also refused to pay her taxes, and she said, look, I'm not paying because I don't want my money to go to war. I want it to go to my community. She also refused to participate in the goodwill, essentially the goodwill games between the U.S. and Russia in track and field, because she didn't want to be a political pawn. And unfortunately, unfortunately, because she's a black woman and also because she's not a top, you know, flight athlete, nobody was really paying attention to her. So the information you get is like here and there, like little pieces that you have to put together. But if she was a man, right, this would be the biggest thing, right? It would be as big as John Carlson, Tommy Smith. It would be as big as Ali. But because she's a black woman, because she's not a top flight athlete, few people paid attention to her. But she is really the mother of this movement.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We are talking about athletes and activism today with our guest. You just heard Dr. Lewis Moore, who is an historian and author of, among other things, We Will Win the Day, The Civil Rights Movement, The Black Athlete, and The Quest for Equality. Dr. Moore is at Grand Valley University. Also, Dr. Johnny Smith is with us, who is professor of sports history at Georgia Tech University. Victoria Jackson, sports historian and former collegiate and professional track and field athlete, joins us, where she is at Arizona State University. And Ann Lieberman is with us, director of policy and programs at Athlete Ally. Let me come back to you, Dr. Moore, for a moment, because we noted that you are working on a book about the black quarterback, and there's been a lot of debate about that. Relatively speaking, given the number of black athletes or black players there are in the NFL, there have been relatively few black quarterbacks. I don't want to spoil your book before you publish it, but why is that? What are some of the factors that go into that?
Well, there's that long history of America not seeing black people as thinkers, not seeing them as leaders. And so for the longest time, they were kept out of that position, thinking that they could understand a playbook and also command a team of 65, both black and white. And so they're kept out of that position. And then as you go along, they get tagged with just being athletes, right? And so these are hard to battle against for so many guys, as we see with, say, Lamar Jackson, who was at Louisville, who was a Heisman Trophy winner. And despite the fact that he dominated, the first thing that comes up is his athleticism and not his smarts. And so it really hindered how people viewed him. And so if they're doing that to Lamar Jackson, Heisman Trophy winner, imagine what they're doing to the other guys who are coming up. So this long history has kept a lot of guys out of position that when we see them perform, we see that they perform well.
And Lieberman, let's come back to you. And I want to go back to the transgender athlete issue in sports. Where do you see this going with all these laws being passed in more than a dozen states now? Is there a resolution? Is there now, because there is now, a conservative majority Supreme Court that will, by the way, apparently soon overturn a 50-year-old abortion law. I mean, do you see families moving to states that have laws allowing trans students to play in sports consistent with their gender identity? Where do you see this all going?
So it's a mix of different reactions and responses. In certain states, there have been legal challenges. Some of the laws have been preliminarily enjoined. We do see some families moving, but we see a significant number of families staying to fight this discriminatory legislation that has impacts far beyond trans kids, because these laws are really conversations about policing women's bodies. And that's a conversation that is happening in this country on a much larger scale. You mentioned abortion access. And I think part of the conversation around this issue needs to be the way it is connected to bodily autonomy in this country more broadly. And I also wanted to say, in thinking about athlete activism and some of the athletes that have been the best, strongest, most vocal allies on trans rights have been black women in sports, in various sports across the country. And so this is very connected to what Dr. Moore and Dr. Jackson were saying when we look at the WNBA players who have been supportive of trans inclusion. There has been a very clear connection between the way in which black and brown women's bodies have been consistently policed in the sports and in the media, and drawing that connection between bodily autonomy and rights for trans athletes, and especially trans kids, who these laws are predominantly targeting.
We're talking about athletes and activism in conversation today on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio, and we're going to go to the phones here. Nat is in Louisville. Hello, Nat. Thanks for calling. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rick. My question for your guest is, I'd like to ask them to speculate on social activism and how it might be impacted by the recent decision by the NCAA to adopt the NIL, the name, image, and likeness rule, which is now starting to become a part of collegiate athletics. It seems to me that the power, the shift that is underway is going to go toward the athletes, at least for a while, and that this will cause an opportunity, this will create an opportunity for students, athletes to have even greater power over their own bodies, the future of the sport, and will certainly challenge the status quo in all aspects of where the power dynamic rests. So I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great question, Nat. Thank you so much for calling. Let me turn to you with that, Victoria Jackson, because you spent years as a collegiate athlete. What's your reaction to the introduction, the permission now to benefit from your name, image, and likeness? And again, going back to Nat's question about that ability to affect social change.
Oh, Nat, I mean, that was such an eloquent statement of where we are right now in college sports. The right for athletes to make money from third parties in these kind of contractual engagements with companies and corporations, that's a result of the last 20 years of former college athlete activism and current college athletes too. And yeah, name, image, and likeness is just one small piece of a much broader rebellion against the NCAA. And there are many different ways in which athletes are kind of working very hard to restore this power imbalance, you know, with support from antitrust legal cases to, you know, what we saw in California with the state legislature passing the first in the country Fair Pay to Play Act, which sparked, you know, this move toward dropping the restrictions on name, image, and likeness. But what gets me so excited about young people in college sports is that, you know, they're not greedy. So many of them are using this opportunity to, you know, be the change they want to see in the world. And the creativity in some of these NIL deals that we've been seeing have been community focused. There was a Michigan football player who did a turkey drive for Thanksgiving to donate turkeys to local families. I mean, things like that and of that nature. And, you know, the business model in college sports right now is focused primarily on making money off of college football and college basketball players. And that, you know, we've hit a moment of reckoning, and economic rights are civil rights. So having the right to make money, you know, the schools have been making billions of dollars off the performances of these athletes for nearly a century now. And for athletes to get a piece of that, you know, means that they're going to do precisely what the caller was saying, to be able to enact change in the world in ways beyond just making money for playing their sport.
Yeah, one of the more encouraging things I've seen is the higher profile athletes who get the big NIL deals have put conditions on it saying, well, if I'm going to do this, I want to bring my teammates in and have them be a part of this autograph show or, you know, or whatever it is. That's been very encouraging. You just heard the voice of Victoria Jackson, a sports historian and former collegiate and professional track and field athlete. Also with us is Dr. Lewis Moore at Grand Valley State University, who is with us from there. Dr. Johnny Smith, professor of sports history at Georgia Tech, and Ann Lieberman, director of policy and programs at Athlete Ally. We're going to talk to them and to you after a break on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. What I'm going to shoot them for what? How can I go shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? I'll just take me to jail.
Well, that's the unmistakable voice of Muhammad Ali talking about his decision to resist the draft, not being and not be inducted in the Army back during the Vietnam War. And we are talking about athletes and activism on In Conversation here on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio with our four guests, Ann Lieberman, Director of Policy and Programs at Athlete Ally. Also, Victoria Jackson, sports historian, former collegiate and professional track and field athlete. Professor Lewis Moore is with us from Grand Valley State University, where he's a historian and author. And Dr. Johnny Smith, who is professor of sports history at Georgia Tech University. Let's go to the phone here and talk to, looks like we have Lameen on the line in Lexington. Hello, Lameen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
I can. Go right ahead. Thank you.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was just wondering, one of your guests, I'm not sure if it's Dr. Morrison or Dr. Smith, who is having an upcoming book about the black quarterback. After hearing him explain the context of his book, at least the synopsis of it, it got me thinking, that's actually the black experience across the board, the way I'm looking at it. It's not just the experience of the black quarterback, but it's also the experience of the black coach, for example, in America, the black manager in America, the black professor in America, experience the same thing, and hence the few number of blacks in thinking positions and leadership positions. And I was wondering how he would take that viewpoint or that perspective. The other thing I wanted to say quickly is that I'm an immigrant of Africa, right? I came from the smallest country in Africa to the United States to get higher education. My experience in this country has been what I just said. And then I was able to go from college all the way to graduate school, PhD in neuroscience, and ended up at Harvard Medical School. However, throughout that journey, what I've experienced is that I was always presumed to be inefficient until I have to prove myself to be otherwise. And that's the experience of the black person in America, the way I see it, not just to the quarterback, but the coach, like I said, the manager, even at McDonald's, and so on and so forth. Thank you very much.
Lameen, thanks so much for your call. Very good call. I'll let you respond to Lameen's call.
Yeah, Lameen is right. And that's where sports plays its part, or that's where people hoped it played its part, right? This idea that if you could see a black manager in baseball, so the first one was Frank Robinson in the 1975 season, a black head coach in football, Art Shell, 1989, then maybe it trickles down to society, right? So if you see Frank Robinson winning, you see Art Shell winning, or you see Lamar Jackson being successful, then maybe you'll give me an opportunity. And this is what, you know, a lot of Black Americans wanted, right? This is why they push for the manager, the coach, and the quarterback. It's not just about the individual, it's about the group, right? And that's for them, for so many people who can't be a professional athlete, who can't be a college athlete, that was the promise of sports, right? That America could see what true meritocracy looked like, what democracy in action looked like.
Dr. Johnny Smith, let me come back to you. Let me go back to my question. I think we have you on the line now talking about Muhammad Ali and other athletes who faced some serious consequences. We'll talk about Colin Kaepernick as well in a moment, but Ali lost several years of boxing due to his taking that stand in the draft, didn't he?
He sure did. And I think in the process, though, he gained many admirers, particularly black athletes, who said that Ali gave them courage to take political stands as well. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Arthur Ashe come to mind as two prominent athletes during the late 1960s who said that Ali's example inspired them to become more vocal, to become more militant in some ways. And so I think when we think about Ali's legacy, he shaped not only these prominent sports stars like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Arthur Ashe, but also black collegians, amateur athletes, who looked to him as well as an example, a role model. And when we think back to that moment in 1967, 1968, when Harry Edwards, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and a group of black athletes organized the Olympic boycott movement, one of their chief demands was the restoration of Muhammad Ali's heavyweight title. He had been stripped of his title, his boxing license, because of his refusal to enter the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. So my point is that here was someone in Ali who was inspiring others to confront the system, not just the sports establishment, but also inequality outside the world of sports. And so this is also a time, too, when Ali not only becomes a hero to many Black militants, but also a unifying force among Black Americans who also recognized that the United States military was disproportionately drafting Black men and that Black men were disproportionately being killed on the front lines in Vietnam. And so Ali, in this moment, he increasingly demonstrates that he's not simply a mouth for the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, but that he was a free thinker and that he was willing to risk everything for something he believed in.
We are talking about athletes and activism on In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Just heard the voice of Dr. Johnny Smith, who's a professor of sports history at Georgia Tech University. Also with us is Professor Lewis Moore from Grand Valley State University in Michigan, who's a historian and author. Also, Victoria Jackson is with us. Dr. Victoria Jackson, sports historian, a former collegiate and professional track and field athlete. And Ann Lieberman is with us, director of policy and programs at Athlete Ally. Let's go to Phil in Louisville, and this is a great transition to a topic I wanted to talk about, pay equity in sports. Phil, welcome to the program.
Can you hear me okay?
I can. Go right ahead.
Great. Well, I'm loving the show. I love sports, and particularly this theme of racial equality and gender equality is very heartwarming. So thank you for the show. I just wanted to hear any comment from your panelists about the recent decision in soccer to have equity pay, which appears to me to be not just the act of an individual, but an act of two leagues and an national organization to deal with economic equality in the midst of some of the other pieces that your program is treating, racial and gender equality.
Yes, this just happened this week, right? There was an announcement that there would be pay equity in soccer. Let me turn to you, Ann Lieberman, because you mentioned Megan Rapinoe earlier, and I know she's been at the forefront of this. What's your reaction to what we've learned this week about soccer and pay equity?
My first reaction is it's about time. You know, this has been years long in the making, and Megan Rapinoe and the U.S. Women's National Team have really been at the forefront of this fight. And so what this essentially means is that the women's team will be paid at the same rate for game appearances and tournament victories as the men's team. So it's the first time that this is happening in the U.S., but not the first time internationally that this kind of pay equity has been achieved.
Let me turn to you, Victoria Jackson. What are your thoughts after hearing this news this week?
I mean, just like what Ann was saying, this is decades of work and decades in the making. Cindy Parlow-Cohn is the head of the U.S. Soccer Federation right now, and she was on that just super important 1999 World Cup winning team. That team, more than anything, has been working relentlessly all through their playing days and ever since to try to bring gender equity to US soccer. And, you know, this is a sport because of historical circumstances. You know, the United States is kind of uniquely positioned in the world to be a leader on this because the world sport is soccer and the world manly sport is soccer. And so we've had FAs around the world historically ban women from playing the game. Whereas in the United States, our manly sport was American football, which literally evolved out of soccer. So we kind of, because of those historical forces, have had this gap created where women's soccer could take on a sort of leadership role in bringing gender equity. And it's much more than pay. It's both the quantitative and the qualitative experience of equal opportunity. And what I love about this story too, is that the US men's national team worked as allies in this fight. This was a CBA with both the women's national team and the men's national team. And it also illustrates that equity is not a zero-sum game. Men got something out of this too. The US men's national team now has childcare, for example. And
And that's just one small example of what I mean when I say the qualitative experience of equal opportunity, things like travel and accommodations, the feel of being legitimate and just as legitimate as the other group of athletes that are playing the same sport as you are. And so what's great and the next step here is to take on FIFA next, to make sure those World Cup prize money structures are equitable. Soccer is really the only international sports federation that has massively disparate payouts in their World Cup or international world championships tournament prize money allocations. And so it's time to correct that too.
Are there still, Dr. Jackson, pay inequities in other major sports like tennis and golf?
You know, thanks to Billie Jean King, I mean, we talk about it being a collection of people, and tennis is really the result of Billie Jean King and the army of people she's brought together over the years to advocate for equity. Most sports, when it comes to representing your national team, have equity in those prize money structures. When we're talking about private or professional leagues, that becomes a different story. But tennis is a space that works the hardest to get the Grand Slam, to have equal prize money payouts. And, you know, of course, there's still inequities built in beyond that. The endorsement deals in individual sports, you know, that's how you put together the money to pay for what you do. Whereas in team sports, you have a league salary and that sort of thing, or a franchise salary. So there's still a lot of work to do, but the one space where we can make the case for change toward equity is with these national teams and federations and international competitions with prize money structures.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking about athletes and activism. You just heard from Dr. Victoria Jackson, sports historian, former collegiate and professional track and field athlete. Also with us is Ann Lieberman. They are director of policy and programs at Athlete Ally, which is been raising awareness and taking various stands and helping folks within the LGBTQI plus community. Also, Dr. Lewis Moore, Professor Lewis Moore, author and historian who is at Grand Valley State University in Michigan, and Dr. Johnny Smith, Professor of Sports History at Georgia Tech University. Dr. Smith, I want to come back to you, and others can talk about this as well if you would like to do that. I want to talk about sports and patriotism and nationalism. You know, many sports, football, baseball, chief among them, have aligned with the military. The Blue Angels, you know, fly over during the national anthem. What's the story? What's the history behind that? How did that come about? Is it an offshoot of, you know, like the World War II era? And it seems like it's also now become a business partnership with the military branches.
Yeah, I think you're right about that last point. We have to go back to the First World War. During that period, the Star Spangled Banner was being played by military bands in baseball stadiums before games started. And one of the things that Randy Roberts and I wrote about in our book, War Fever, which tells a story about Boston and World War I and Babe Ruth, is how in this moment during the war, these stadiums became politicized. They became spaces where the United States government wanted to sell its foreign policy. And although the Star Spangled Banner did not really become regularly played before sporting events until after World War II, the seeds were planted during the First Great War. One of the interesting changes takes place in the post-World War II period is technology. Now you have sound systems that allow them to broadcast throughout the stadium a recording of the anthem. But also, as Howard Bryant has shown in his book, The Heritage, in the post-9/11 period, increasingly, the U.S. government, the State Department, the Department of Defense has also taken on an active role in selling U.S. foreign policy in these tributes to the troops, promoting this idea that sports and American government's foreign policy aims are intertwined. And I think what's interesting about that is that what's happened culturally during that time period is that people have felt this increasing pressure when they're in public to demonstrate their patriotism, to demonstrate their loyalty. So sports and sports stadiums have long played a role as a space where Americans are encouraged to demonstrate their patriotism in a very public way.
Yeah, before we run out of time, Professor Lewis Moore, we have to talk about Colin Kaepernick, who's recently really become the face of, in many ways, of activism among athletes. Of course, Colin Kaepernick, the NFL quarterback who knelt during on the sideline during the national anthem, no longer playing, and he won a settlement with the NFL for being kind of pushed out of the league. But what do you see his legacy and his impact on the game and sports in general at this point?
It's huge. It will be up there with, you know, Jackie Robinson, Ali, John Carlos, Tommy Smith. And even though he doesn't get a chance to play, I think just on the one hand, the symbol of kneeling has become, like, you know, for a few years, like the Black Power Fist, right? And so he gives a symbol to the movement. He also gives a face to the movement about athletes and activism and really going after police brutality, right? And so I think now that we're still having conversations, and we've had conversations about police brutality for the last 150 years, but putting that at the forefront and not making it about both sides, just like, let's just talk about police brutality, I think he gave a lot of people a voice. He sacrificed everything for it, like his career. I know he's making money other ways, but I think, you know, when you put it all together, you know, guys like Ali, Jackie Robinson, they were disliked, right, in real time. Mm-hmm. John Carlos, Tommy Smith were disliked in real time, but now they're heroes. And I think Kaepernick will go down and with that type of legacy.
I want to thank you all for joining us. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Dr. Johnny Smith, Professor Lewis Moore, Dr. Victoria Jackson, and Ann Lieberman of Athlete Ally. Thank you all so much for joining us. And thanks to our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyreen Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, and Russell Wells. Bill Burton anchors our local newscast, and Kojin Toshiro composed our opening and closing theme. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.